You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Susan Faludi is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author, best known for her books about culturally imposed gender roles, their limitations, and the consequences of stepping outside of them. But her investigations into those topics may not have prepared her for the email she received from her father after 25 years of silence, announcing a sex change operation. Ms. Faludi's new book, In the Darkroom, is his story and hers. It's published by Metropolitan Books, and I'm so glad that it brings Susan Faludi back to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you.
And before we begin, can we establish terminology? Should we refer to your father as he before the operation and she after it, or always as she?
Well, in my case, my father preferred to be he before, she after, and on top of that, preferred to be for me to refer to her as my father. As my father put it, I'm still your father.
So that has to be odd, referring to a woman as dad.
She was fine with it. You have to keep in mind, and I guess we'll get to this in a moment, that we're in Hungary all the time where we're talking, and in Hungary, Hungarian does not have gendered pronouns. So my father...
Well, that makes it so much easier.
Yes, and in fact, you can always tell a Hungarian because they'll mix up... When they're speaking in English, they mix up the pronouns.
What was your relationship with your father like before you received that email in which she informed you that he'd had a sex change operation?
Not so good.
You hadn't had much contact?
Yeah, we'd barely spoken in a quarter century. And the reason for that is that when I was growing up, my father was the kind of quintessential hyper-masculine, aggressive, domineering patriarch, overbearing to his children and especially to his wife, and even violent at times, all of which I relate in the book. So yeah, we hadn't spoken in quite a while.
And that must have the announcement. First of all, how did she tell you that she'd had the sex change operation?
She wrote me an email, which the subject line of which was changes. And she said, "Dear Susan, I have some interesting news for you. I have decided that I am not the... I've had enough of impersonating the macho, aggressive man I've never been inside." My father is a photographer, high-end commercial photographer, mainly did photographic development work, sort of an expert on Photoshop before the age of Photoshop. So my father preferred to express herself through image, not text. So the text of the announcement was very short, and then there were several photographs of my father in wearing, you know, dresses. And
but this must have come as a big shock because, whether she felt she had been impersonating a macho man or not, she had done a pretty good job.
Yes.
And I'm sure you never imagined that your father would have been somebody who had gone through that. You've written a lot about gender. Did what she said make any sense to you?
Well, over time it did. And, you know, growing up, I knew that my father put on a lot of masks, tried on a lot of roles, a lot of identities, and that something didn't quite add up. But it seemed like a more global confusion about identity, not specifically about gender.
Did you ever wonder if somehow subliminally the kinds of issues that you've spent your career exploring were influenced by that relationship?
No doubt. I mean, I think I'll leave that for the psychoanalyst. But yes, I mean, certainly my feminism was, catapulted by my father's retrograde exhibition of masculinity and his insistence on controlling the family. And And so, yes, to that degree, I was always conscious of that.
Well, most of the people who go through sex change operations functions as heterosexuals before they had the change. At least among the men, they were not homosexuals who decided that they wanted to be women. It's different than being a transvestite. So this has to do with some totally different thing. It's not playing out a role.
Right. And my father's desire to be a woman was undeniable.
Well, you say in your introduction that you started out to investigate someone you scarcely knew, but hadn't you lived with your father full time until you were 16 years old?
And I knew that part of my father, but my father was very hidden, rarely talked about personal matters.
When you went hiking and did other things together?
Yes, and I talk about this in the book, that when I think back, what did we talk about? All this, because one of my father's guises was big mountaineer, ice climbing, rock climbing. My father and I went bicycling across the Alps. But my father tended to have two modes, either silent and often kind of smoldering anger, or to talk endlessly on a subject of technical and bureaucratic or procedural matters that would just bore you out of your mind.
You were a runner in high school. What happened when he went out to run with you one day?
Well, you know, when I'm in the book, when I talk about casting back, trying desperately to find some instance of some revelation, that some moment that would be a portal into where my father.
And you say that you don't remember a lot of the things that happened in the past because they just were so unmemorable. Did that make it more difficult when you were trying to find these clues as to what had happened?
It's not that I couldn't remember. It's just that my father was so hidden that it wasn't there. And so this moment I talk about in the book, when my father and I went running and we ended up, because I was on the junior varsity track team. Not that I was very good, but I was very determined. And so on this one morning, my father announced that he was going to be running also with me. And toward the end of the run, it became this intense race. And we're struggling. He's pulling ahead of me. I'm pulling ahead of him. He finally pulled way ahead of me. And in that moment, I remembered thinking, as I saw his back recede, you know, in some ways, it's easier to be a woman. All these years later, I was sort of putting that together with my father's yearning to be a woman. I know when my father talked to me about what was most appealing to her about how she saw womanhood was that she felt she could actually talk with other people, that she could communicate, that she felt less isolated.
Susan Faludi is my guest. Her latest book, In the Dark Room, which has a couple of meanings here. Your father, as you say, was a photographer, but was also living, you suggest, in a dark room that perhaps even she wasn't totally conscious of?
I think she was aware that she was isolated, and one of the things she talked about a lot after the change in gender was that she felt she could talk to people more, in particular that she could talk to women more, which I thought was interesting.
Your father grew up Jewish in Hungary during the period before and during World War II, and a lot of the people who lived through that time found it very hard to talk about it under any circumstances,
yes.
Not just your father. How did he talk at all about those experiences?
Well, growing up, I had a few little examples that were more shards than stories. I mean, one where, you know, my father was living pretty much an urchin on the street in Budapest, particularly in the last year of the war, and was passing or trying to pass as a Christian with false identity papers and a stolen fascist armband. So I knew a few stories from that period, living off a dead horse carcasses on the street. One time when he was pulled into a building that was a headquarters for the Hungarian Nazi Arrow Cross and almost was shot. And the third one, a rather key moment in his life, when he said that he rescued his parents who were in an endangered safe house. And I always sort of wondered if that story was grandiose, some kind of boy Superman fantasy. And when I went to Hungary and then later to Israel to talk to the extended family, I discovered that, in fact, that was a true story.
Did he bring you up to see yourself as Hungarian or as a Jew?
Well, this goes to a central problem in Hungary where the history of Hungary is such that either you're Hungarian or you're a Jew. That goes back centuries. This is true even though in the last half of the 19th century, there was a period in Hungary known as the Golden Age for Hungarian Jewry because Hungary was late to industrialize and late to modernize and for complicated reasons where there was sort of an aristocracy on one end and, desperately poor peasants on the other. There was no sort of middle class. So this was a window in which Hungarian Jews became basically the bourgeoisie of Hungary and built up the country, did incredible things culturally, and really were disproportionately responsible for the urbanizing and modernizing of the country and for its cultural flowering at the turn of the century.
And were resented.
Well, at the time, they were embraced. Huh. And the promise was, we will give you all this power and authority to shape the country if in turn you drop your name, take Hungarian names, take Hungarian customs, to sort of quote-unquote correct yourself, as was the terminology of the time. And thousands and thousands of Jews did this. So it was so shocking when, after World War I, there was that social contract broke apart and there was an immense upwelling of anti-Semitism, ultimately leading, as we know, to what happened in World War II.
And do we know why?
Well, I think that anti-Semitism had always been there. Well,
it's been said that once you cross the Danube, you should expect people to be anti-Semitic.
Yes. I mean, it's got, if I could answer that question, I...
Well, when your parents were married, wasn't the ceremony to the horror of your mother's parents who boycotted the wedding in a synagogue?
So anti-Semitism doesn't just rain on that side of the Danube. My grandparents on my mother's side were not too excited about this, even though my grandfather was actually Jewish. But Jewish self-hatred has a long history, too, as we know.
But your father felt Jewish enough to have the marriage in a synagogue. What kind of marriage did your parents have?
It was hard because, my father... was difficult and controlling, and didn't want his wife to work, and insisted on moving into a suburb, far from the city, and, you know, working and actually journalism was really important to my mother. So, you know, and it was those times, right, of late 50s, early 60s, that were so crushing to so many women. That's another fount of my feminism, is seeing, you know, not just my mother, but all the women in that neighborhood, and how stifled their creative aspirations were because of those, that period.
You describe something that happened on a night in 1976 as a hinge moment in your life, and an event that showed you the undergirding of traditional, the traditional arrangement of the sexes. What happened?
My father, and there was a sort of longer tale on this, where my father, you know, my mother sought a divorce. My, you know, it's kind of classic. My father was fighting it, and so there was a lot of threatening, physical violence, throwing things. There were temporary restraining orders issued to get him out of the house. He was not supposed to come back. And then one night he did, and, you know, with a baseball bat that he later claimed to me that he had to defend himself, although there's he was the intruder. So, yeah, it was a pretty, pretty much of a violent mess. And again, this was a moment that led to my feminism, not just because of my father's violence, but because of how the larger institutions dealt with it.
You know, well, my father, you were always taking your mother's side.
Well, I certainly was, and I still take my mother's side on that. You know, I don't in any way, this examination of my father does not exonerate his behavior. But, you know, afterward, he was let out on bail, on tiny bail, and, you know, just got a slap on the wrist, was allowed to pay very little child support. So all of the, looking at how the system itself was rigged against women was very eye-opening to me.
Did you see much of him after that?
Not so. That was the beginning of our estrangement. You know, so I'd see him at family events, and it's not like we weren't in contact at all. But and then in 1990, he moved back to Hungary, so there was also an ocean between us.
And do you think that when she got in touch with you, that she hoped that the change would bring the two of you closer together? Because now you're both women.
I think there may have been some of that.
And that the sex change might have left all of that terrible behavior behind?
Yeah, well, there was a great wish that, you know, that was then and this is now, that this would be one of these kind of makeovers where we could just forget what had happened before. It, you know, it was a fantasy like, you know, a religious conversion, you know, where you say some magic words and everything goes away. And that, over time, my father accepted that I was not going to forget and that we were going to have to address and talk about what had happened.
Do you think that's why he invited you to write his story or her story?
I think that's part of it. I think there are many reasons.
Although he wanted you to write it like a fairy tale. He said, like a Hans Christian Andersen.
Right, right. She said, yeah, the fiction can be more true than fact. My father was a great fan of Hans Christian Andersen, of fairy tales in general. But I think in the end, my father wanted to be perceived. And she didn't care how she was, she was okay with her, amazingly, to be perceived, warts and all, because I did say to her, look, this book has a lot of things in here you're not going to like, and she said, okay.
Isn't it rare for someone her age to have a sex change operation?
Yes, and another theme with my father, she was a lifelong trickster. She got away. It was, as she said, her favorite phrase was getting away with it. So when she had the operation, she was 76 years old, and she was worried that they wouldn't operate on somebody of that age. So she altered all of her records, you know, all her medical records, her birth certificate, and sent these faked records to the surgeon, who didn't question them.
Do you know if she followed the pre-operation protocols? They're pretty extensive.
Yeah, she actually did not. In the most important of those protocols, there's a, it's called the, you know, standards of care that surgeons are supposed to, or, you know, expected to follow. The most important aspect of that is two letters from two independent mental health professionals, you know, therapists, who have evaluated the patient and acknowledge and believe the patient's eligible for surgery. And my father did not get those letters, and instead made up a letter from a friend, which my father wrote herself and sent from her email address to the surgeon. So why that didn't tip the surgeon off, I don't know. But
do you think that returning to Hungary was all part of the same process? Because Hungary must have held really awful memories for her.
Yes, and one of the abiding mysteries for me is, did my father return to Hungary to at last fit in, to finally be, as my father always put it, 100% Hungarian? Or did my father return to say, to basically thumb her nose at the country and say, okay, you know, you couldn't accept me as a Jew, well, try this on for size? And I don't know. I mean, I do know that Hungary is not exactly a friendly place to, you know, if you're gay or trans, and not a friendly place if you're Jewish. And yet that was where my father went to have this, you know, to then transform herself on gender terms as well.
You talk about Hungarian architecture and the conflation of security and self-display, and compare it to the confusion of feminine and masculine that's a feature of the language.
Yes, well, as I said,
there's no masculine or feminine.
There's no gendered pronouns. One of the things on the security front is that my father always was seemed very preoccupied with having alarms. My father had several like security alarms on her VW camper, and then on the perimeter of the house, and there was a big, you know, fence, and then there was one inside. And I thought this was all very elaborate, but then, you know, one of the interesting things about spending time in Hungary is I learned that some of the aspects of my father that I thought were very curious were actually just very Hungarian, because, in fact, there's a lot of that kind of security-gated approach to architecture, particularly in the Buda Hills where my father was living.
Did your father have a chance to read the book before she died?
No, I offered it, and I said, you know, I have a readable draft now, and she didn't take me up on it, which is, I still puzzle over why that was. She just said, oh, in her Hungarian, lifelong Hungarian accent with a stretched out vowel, she said, that's fantastic, and continued to tell people, you know, my daughter's coming out with this book about me. And I don't, you know, and she knew that there were things that would make her squirm, and perhaps she chose to, at a late date, give me the gift of letting me write the book that felt true to me.
Susan Faludi is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and the best-selling author of The Terror Dream, Stiffed, and Backlash, which won the National Book Critics Circle Award for nonfiction. Her latest, In the Dark Room, is published by Metropolitan Books, and it has been my great pleasure to have you as a guest on our show again.
Thanks so much for having me.